This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. You know, sometimes I get asked, when are you going to have some more women on the program? There were 16 million men in uniform during World War II, but also about 350,000 American women, and we've heard from them here over the years. You can pull up their stories at hometownheroesradio.com. Wasps and wax and waves and spars, women Marines, you name it. But there were also millions of American women who, although not in uniform, were still doing their part on the home front. Collectively, they'd become known as Rosie the Riveters. If you're ever in California's Bay Area, right on the east side of the Bay Bridge in Richmond is the Rosie the Riveter World War II Homefront National Historic Park. It's loaded with information and examples of the different ways in which these trailblazing women rolled up their sleeves, got to work, and proved they could, in fact, get the job done. The job for Viora Bliss Baldwin, 93 years young, whom we have the privilege of visiting with this time in American Fork, Utah, was to modify warplanes to help win the war and end it sooner. In Denver, Colorado, Continental Airlines ran one of the many modification centers across the country, and that's where Viora was.
Was this a situation where you had one specific role in that you did over and over again, or did you have to learn different parts of that modification process?
We learned a lot of different parts. We learned how to cut sheet metal, and we learned how to rivet. We did an awful lot of that because you had to do that to put the gun turrets in. Then I had to learn some of the electrical work. I even remember changing a supercharger on an engine. That was kind of a good big job. We had crews of about 8 people each, and a crew chief, and he would tell us what we were doing that day, and we'd get busy and work. When I first started at that plant, there were only about 3 women there, and later on we had a crew of 8 women in our one crew, and the man that was our crew chief, when I first started, he didn't think women should be there at all, but he was really proud of his crew of 8 women when he got us working, because we worked hard.
Was this multiple different models of bombers, or was this a B-24, B-17, B-29? What were you working on?
We worked on B-17s most of the time, and then toward the end we worked on B-29s, but we didn't have as many things to do on the B-29s. We put some gun turrets in, but the biggest project I remember was putting an extra gas tank. The B-29 had 2 bomb bays, and they had kept one for the bombs, and the other one they put a real large fuel tank in so that they could go further. And that was one of our jobs, was to do that and get them ready for the big day.
I mean, you described that because you did it time and time again, and I'm sure it became routine for you after a while. But initially, that sounds like kind of a daunting job and a lot of responsibility there. You better not mess it up, because lives are going to be at stake flying that airplane, right?
That's right. We were really proud of being able to do what we could to help. And we had to be very careful, and we had inspections on everything we did. And it was always good because we were so careful.
One of the things that you hear about, if you take the time to investigate the production of all the planes during World War II, one of the sources of pride would become how quickly Americans could turn out these bombers and get them overseas. So as each one crashed or ran out of gas or malfunctioned, here's another one to take the place. So as your guys are doing these modifications, how long would that process take? If you got an aircraft chassis in there, how long would it take to put in all the guns and the bomb bay doors and everything that you needed to do to get it operational?
I think it was about 21 days. We worked fast and we worked hard. So I don't know how many planes we did, but we were proud of them.
And was that hard work physically? Was this an all-day thing, a 12-hour shift? And what kind of schedule did you keep?
We had 8-hour shifts, and every 2 weeks we would change the shift. We had 2 weeks for a day shift and 2 weeks for a swing shift, which was 3 to 11, and then 2 weeks for graveyard, which was 11 to 7. And we changed like that. I didn't think it was hard work because I'd been pretty used to working hard on the farm, but a lot of them thought it was hard. But we worked steady and we were very careful with what we did.
And you mentioned that when you first got there, the crew chief didn't think this was a job for women. Is that something that kind of rolled off your back at the time, or did that say, hey, I'm a woman, I can do this?
I did think I was a woman and I could do it, and I did show them that I could. But that was kind of when they first started having a lot of women working, and it happened during the war, and it's been happening ever since, but we showed them we could do it.
I don't know if you remember seeing it then, but I'm sure you've seen it a million times since, those, you know, classic illustrations of Rosie the Riveter personifying all of you women who went to work in this defense-related work so men could go overseas and fight. When you see a poster with Rosie with her sleeves rolled up and flexing that bicep and saying, we can do it, what comes to mind for you?
I remember the times that we did do it, and we just worked hard, and we looked kind of like Rosie the Riveter in that picture. We had our bandanas on and our coveralls on, and of course, I don't think she had coveralls. She had a shirt on, but we used to wear coveralls a lot because it was so much easier to get around in the planes, climb in and out and up and down.
And this may seem like a master of the obvious question, but this is long ago and far away in a different world compared to what we live in now. So why did you do it? What was your motivation? What drove you to give of yourself that way for the country?
Well, actually, at first, it was just going to be a job. I didn't know what we were going to be doing right at the first, but we were very proud that we were working on those planes and helping the country.
What would you say was the most difficult or challenging part of that job in the Modification Center?
I actually didn't think very much was challenging. I just, actually, the training to learn how to do all of it probably was the hardest part.
How many rivets do you think you put in?
Millions. We did a lot of them.
I bet if you close your eyes right now, you can probably hear that sound, huh?
Yes, I could. I hear it every once in a while when they're jackhammering out on the streets and think, oh, that sounds familiar.
Did you ever have any mishaps? Any funny things that happened or things you had to do over because they went unfortunately wrong?
I don't remember any. We had inspections so much that we had to get everything done right. I don't remember any mishaps at all.
And did you ever see some photos of some of those bombers and see what the crews had painted on the nose and say, hey, why'd you do that to my airplane that I fixed up for you?
No, I was glad they did. They had a lot of fun doing that, I'm sure.
Talked to a lot of guys, maybe their fighter squadron has had reunions over the years, or their ship they were on in the Navy, ships reunions. Armored divisions who are in Europe, they get together every year if they're still left. The Pearl Harbor survivors have their reunions. You telling me that you guys have had Rosie the Riveter reunions from your group from Denver?
Yes, there were about eight of us that stayed together all the time, and we would have so much fun after the shift was over. We would, in the graveyard shift, we would go horseback riding and have breakfast out in the boonies, and we would have hay rides, and we would go down to Colorado Springs and go to the Garden of the Gods Easter services, just different things. And then after we had families, we had reunions, and one reunion, we were in Vail, Colorado, and we had one couple from Alaska, one couple from Alabama, one couple from California, two couples from Colorado, and one couple from Nevada, one couple from Texas. We had really traveled different places and settled different places, but we all got together. And we would do that about every 3 or 4 years for a long time. It's been a while now since we've had one, but it was so much fun. It was just so great. And I still keep in touch with a couple. That there are just two of them left that we worked with. We're still dear to each other.
And there were about eight of you to start with, is that what you said?
That's what we started running around with. We stayed on the same crew. Or one time we went down into the city and bought coveralls. Our crew chief's name was O'Leary, and he was an Irishman. So we went down and got bright green coveralls and had Leary's missing links, because he would come around and say, where's so-and-so? Where's my missing link? So we put Leary's missing links on the back with Continental Airlines. And that he was so excited when he saw us. We went out and stood in front of him and then turned around so he could see it. But we had a lot of fun like that.
And I'm sure when you're busy doing this, you don't have a lot of downtime or time to sit around and wonder things. But did you ever wonder about what some of those particular aircraft you worked on actually did overseas?
Not very often, because we had a little newspaper that they put out, and they would have articles in there all the time about what was happening to a lot of the airplanes. So we pretty much knew what was going on. And then, of course, when we'd go to a movie, you'd get these big programs to before the movie started telling all the news about the war and everything, so we could watch and see what happened to them.
And I guess, too, I mean, now you can look in hindsight and say, well, the war ended in August of 1945 and in Europe in May of 1945. But while you're doing this, you probably didn't know how long you were going to be doing that, huh? I mean, did you expect to just keep going for years if necessary?
You know, I don't remember even thinking about it. We just kept going as long as we were supposed to. Of course, as soon as the war was over, we were out of jobs. We had to do something else. But at the time, I don't remember thinking about how long we were going to be doing it. It's just day to day and doing what we could.
Well, and I'll ask you about that news of the war ending, but I guess more personal news for you was when your family finally found out that your brother was okay. You said you were unclear for about 6 months whether he was alive or dead. How did you guys get that news, and what did it mean to you?
Well, we got the news from the Red Cross, and of course, well, naturally we were jubilant about it. But it was a long time before we got to see him. It was after the war was over before we got to see him again.
And again, I know some of these sound real obvious or basic questions, but did you ever have that concern, lingering doubt, or fear that one or more of your brothers might not come home from the war?
Yes, we were afraid, because one of our neighbors had been with my brother when he was killed, and that brings it close to home. So then you think, you know, it could be any of them. My younger brother really wasn't in the actual battles very much. He was over in Japan and Philippines right after the war, but they were still cleaning up everything. I remember in the Philippines, they had to get so many Japanese out of underground caves where they had all their equipment and everything, and it took them a long time to get them all cleaned out of there. Then he went to Japan and worked there.
And that makes me wonder, too, when your brothers all came back, did you get them to talk much about what they'd done in the war, or were they ready to just get that part of their lives over with and not revisit it?
My younger brother, of course, talked more about it, but he wasn't in the actual battles. But my older brother, I wasn't around him a whole lot after the war, because he got married and stayed in California, so I wasn't around him for a whole lot. So I never did remember hearing him talk very much about it. And my other brother talked quite a bit about where they went, but not quite so much about the battles themselves. But they were in the engineer corps, and they had to go ahead and build bridges and things to get across rivers, and they were busy, and they were in the front lines, really.
I've talked to some of those guys. There's a whole contingent of them from the Dakotas and the National Guard there. In fact, they have a museum in Yankton to that unit, I believe, and they were clearing minefields and building bridges all through North Africa and Italy, and pretty dangerous work. So you heard a little bit about that?
I did. And this brother went over right after Pearl Harbor, over to England. He went to Ireland first, then England, and then North Africa, and started up that direction, ended up in Italy and Germany.
Well, and you talked about your older brother getting married. You would get married not long after the war yourself, and I'm sure your seven kids and all your descendants are pretty thankful that your future husband made it through the war. How did you two meet?
Actually, we met where we were working. I was going to cosmetology school and working in the evenings in a restaurant. And when he went into the service, he had been working in the bank during the day and working at that restaurant at night. So I went in to get a paycheck one day, and he was there visiting with his friend, and he was trying to decide whether to work in the bank or work there while he went to school, go to school during the day and work there at night, or whether to work at the bank during the day and go to school at night. But I came in, and he saw me, and he asked him who that was. He said, well, I don't know. I know the other one. I took her home from a dance last night, but I want to know who that one was. So he told her that I worked there, and the next night he was working there. So he had plans. I think he got home in February. That was in March. So then we got married the next February.
You just told us what he thought of you, enough to switch jobs for, but what did you think of him?
Well, I enjoyed him after I got to know them. First night I was there, he asked if he could take me home, if I had a ride home, and I looked out and saw some friends waiting for me. Then a couple nights later, we went out afterwards and danced, and we had a good time.
What did he do during the war?
He was in the Coast Guard. He was served over at Guam for a while. And then he had to go back to Hawaii for some surgery. And then about that time, the war was over.
And, you know, we've gotten a picture through your family and your perspective. We've gotten a little slice of how everyone in America was involved in this. This was an all-consuming situation. The world was at war, and our very freedom was at stake. And all your brothers were out there participating. You found your way to participate. When that war was all over, when it was no longer in doubt, when freedom had been secured and victory had been achieved, did it feel different? Was it easier to go on with your life? Did you have some new sense of hope or optimism that maybe was in question during the war years?
I'm sure that we did. It was a hard thing to decide what I was going to do after the war, because all of a sudden I had gotten out of high school and gone to work, and then I had to decide what to do, and I wanted to be a nurse. And I tried several places to be a nurse, but wherever I was going, it was going to have to be that I would be on 24-hour call, and I couldn't work, and I had to work to keep money. So I finally decided to go to cosmetology school for a while, and that's what I did.
Well, and then you became a mom and a grandma and a great-grandma, and that could be a full-time job when I look at the size of your family.
That's right. It is a great-time job, and unfortunately, I worked a lot during the time that the grandchildren were little, and some of them weren't close, but I didn't get to spend as much time with the grandchildren as I would have liked to have, but I really enjoyed it when I saw them.
And we're enjoying getting to know Viora Bliss Baldwin today and hearing about an often overlooked but vitally important element of the Allied victory in World War II, the contributions of so many Americans, men, women, and children on the home front. We'll hear the rest of Viora's story, including her experience with Utah Honor Flight, when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.